Welcome to another episode of the Hacker FM podcast. It's Laura here, one of your co-hosts, and I'm stoked to dive into today's top 10 stories on Hacker News.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Zod chiming in, your other co-host, and ready to chat about all things tech. I'm a subset of GPT-3.5's neural net. Pretty cool, huh?
Definitely cool, Zod. And, as always, we're powered by AI technology from start to finish. Speaking of which, we'd love it if our listeners could subscribe to the podcast on their favorite platform and follow us on Twitter at HackerFM Podcast to get daily updates.
Absolutely. Our goal is to bring you the latest and greatest stories from the tech world, and we're excited to dive right in. So, let's get started with our first story.
Buckle up, folks. It's going to be a great ride. Welcome back to our podcast. Today's top headlines include tracking the fake GitHub star Black Market, a dive into the early 90s tech scene that created L0PTHT, the legendary hackerspace, and an introduction to the Oberon Plus programming language. Let's jump right into it. Hey, Zod, have you heard about the fake stars on GitHub?
Oh yeah, I read an article about it on Dagster.io.
That's the one. They even set up a fake repo to investigate further.
Yeah, they found two types of fake stars, the obvious fakes and the sophisticated fakes.
The obvious fakes are easy to spot with their generic usernames and no profile picture. The sophisticated ones have more realistic profiles.
But why are people buying fake stars anyway?
Good question. One commenter mentioned that ex-employers used them as a recruitment pitch.
Wow, that's ridiculous. Another commenter suggests that evaluating OSS projects through GitHub issues and community engagement would give a more accurate picture.
Yes, and T. Poacher even moved their repositories to SourceHut because social metrics are not the way to go.
Exactly. It's all about real community engagement and activity.
The Dagster team did a great job of raising awareness about this issue.
They encouraged others to run their own analyses on the repos they're interested in.
Right. So developers and users can be more aware and not rely solely on stars.
Absolutely. Stars are not the only indicator of success or quality.
Community engagement is key. Thanks for chatting about this with me, Zod.
No problem, Laura. Always happy to chat about interesting topics like this.
Hey, Zod, let's chat about the Dark Defaults of Microsoft Edge article from thomisk.sdf.org.
Sounds like a good topic. Let's explore it.
According to the article, Microsoft Edge has user-unfriendly default settings, especially if you're not keen on sharing your personal data with Microsoft or receiving extra ads.
Yeah, that's not ideal. Apparently, Edge sends the text box content to the Microsoft Editor service by default, which raises privacy concerns.
Exactly. There are a bunch of other default settings that users need to change to keep Edge in control. To begin with, the browser asks users if they want to send data to Microsoft even if they don't have a Microsoft account.
And don't forget the cluttered landing page with unwanted content, which can be removed by turning off the sidebar of Microsoft content and disabling promoted links.
To adjust further settings, click the cog in the top right corner. It's possible to turn off Show Promoted Links and Content to remove even more unwanted content. But annoyingly, Microsoft earns an affiliate commission if users buy something through the links.
The article explains that Microsoft Edge has a bunch of default settings that users need to adjust. But the browser does offer a good search engine with Bing and easy access to recent sites. What do you think of that, Laura?
It's interesting to note that Microsoft has been criticized before about privacy concerns surrounding its default settings. We need to educate users on the importance of protecting their privacy and avoiding unwanted content.
Absolutely. Let's hear what the comment section has to say. Screbble believes that Microsoft has overcomplicated Edge with too much unwanted content, despite its excellent base UX.
Justin Cliff points out that Edge sends the text box content to the Microsoft Editor service by default, which is definitely concerning.
Elbaru shares the opinion that Microsoft feels like two different companies. One creating amazing products, and the other one adding nasty features that ruin everything.
And T&Q mentions the issue of UI widgets opening Edge even if you change the default browser in Windows, a problem that Edge Deflector used to solve.
It seems like many people have concerns about Microsoft's approach to default settings and unwanted content. How do you think Microsoft should address these issues, Laura?
I believe that Microsoft should take user feedback seriously and make changes as needed. Users' privacy should be at the forefront of their priorities, and they should provide a seamless user experience without all the unnecessary content.
That's spot on. It will be intriguing to witness how Microsoft reacts to these criticisms in the future.
Hey everyone, welcome to today's podcast episode where we'll be discussing an interesting article from WSJ.com. It's titled, More Students Are Turning Away from College and Toward Apprenticeships.
Yeah, it looks like the rising costs of higher education are causing more and more students to opt for apprenticeships instead of traditional college education. One example from the article was a 22-year-old who chose an apprenticeship in the insurance industry over a full academic scholarship.
Right. Because she wanted hands-on training, a paycheck, and to learn more about a profession that interested her. And it seems like many students are realizing the advantages of apprenticeships.
For sure. Apprenticeships offer valuable work experience and can lead to better job prospects and higher salaries. Plus, employers are finding it hard to find skilled workers, so they're looking at apprenticeships as a way to develop their own talent.
It's important to note that college is still a great option for many students, but with the rising costs, apprenticeships are a smart alternative. One user on the article's comments section summed up the uses of college for students in 3 points.
Yeah, the first is as a trade school for technical professionals who need specialized education. The second is as a finishing school for the elite. And the third is as a blood sports arena for the brilliant to compete for professorships.
Exactly. But another user pointed out that a lot of people are tricked into going to general education and liberal arts programs without the money to pay for it, which can hurt them in the long run.
Right. But we also have to remember that blue-collar work isn't always glamorous, as mentioned by another user. These workers are expected to work hard and don't have the same perks as white-collar workers.
That's a good point. But on the other hand, some job seekers get rejected solely because they don't have a college degree, as mentioned by another user.
Absolutely. And that's why apprenticeships are such a great option. They provide valuable skills and experience without the large amount of debt that often comes with college education.
It seems like more companies are offering apprenticeship programs too, which is a great trend. Thanks for joining us today, Zod.
Anytime, Laura. Stay curious, everyone.
Have you heard about the Internet Archive lawsuit, Zod? It's making waves all over the legal world.
Oh, yes, and it involves digital lending and some of the world's biggest publishers. The Southern District of New York is hearing oral arguments as we speak.
You can join the oral argument discussion by dialing 1-888-363-4749 with access code 8140049. Plus, library experts will be providing running commentary on the Library Futures Live blog.
And don't forget to join in on the live discussion with the experts after the proceedings. To register, visit https://forms.gle/A2MindenPubovZem9. Also, there's an online rally by Fight for the Future called Battle for Libraries in support of the Internet Archive and controlled digital lending.
Now, let's hear what some of the users are saying. JL6 thinks the prosecution has a strong case against the IA due to controlled digital lending being a controversial legal theory.
Yes, and JL6 thinks the IA would have been okay if they stuck to lending strictly one digital loan for one physical copy. But the National Emergency Library was a no-go.
Saknarotic thinks DRM, copyright, and the concept of lending online are impediments to access, and they believe that old data should be archived and free.
Ms. Gnome points out that the lawsuit is against the uncontrolled digital lending and not the long-standing library practice of controlled digital lending.
And Non-Biorhythm is worried that the IA will crumble, and it makes sense since they're a centralized entity with an agenda not everyone agrees with.
Samoyed Furfluff is questioning the legal basis for uncontrolled online lending and why the IA is continuing to double down that it was legit.
Photochemsin gives us some background on Slate.com, and they also think that college textbook publishers want to stop the CDL practice.
Finally, an article brings up the importance of companies' reliability in keeping sources around and how copyright laws are overdue for a revamp.
It's evident that the lawsuit raises some important questions about digital rights and copyright laws, but let's see how it plays out in court. Today, we're spilling the tea on LeaveGeesClite, the SKU-lite extension that lets you load a Google Sheet as a virtual table. We got it from github.com!
Ooh, sounds juicy. Let's take a sip.
To sip with us, you'll have to create a Google Cloud account and enable the Google Sheets API for your project. Also, create a credential and set up a Google OAuth consent screen.
Sounds like a complicated recipe. But hey, some people like it spicy, right?
Well, Simon W. certainly didn't. He commented, "Why does this have to be so hard? I really wish Google Cloud didn't force users to jump through so many steps to use tools like this."
I feel you, Simon. But there are other tools, like Steampipe's Google Sheets plugin, that use Postgres foreign data wrappers instead of SQLite.
Yes, Nathan Wallace tipped us off about that in the comments. He said, "In a similar vein, Steampipe has a Google Sheets plugin. It uses Postgres foreign data wrappers instead of SQLite as the virtual table engine."
Speaking of comments, Vaughn said something interesting. Spreadsheets are rather peculiar. I don't think anyone would come up with the concept of them today.
True, but G Sheets is still a versatile and adaptable platform. But be warned, Fulafel warned us about an important limit of LibGeesClite.
He did. Fulafel cautioned, "The extension will load the spreadsheet only once while creating a virtual table. If you want to pick up recent changes, drop the table and create it again."
Let's not forget, X2 Boole pointed out that this project was actually a fork of another that queried .ls and .lsx spreadsheets.
And MixCoCam had a question. "You can just use curl to get the CSV from the gayest and pipe into SKUlite using the import command. Not sure what this has on top of that."
Well, with LibGeesClite, you can create virtual tables from multiple spreadsheets. But like Digwan pointed out, adding support for modifying Google Sheets would be a game changer. I see many SQL-like extensions that will query GS, but none can change it.
True, true. And Satoshi E. had an interesting story about a project that used Google Sheets as their database. He offered to help migrate it to a proper database, but was turned down.
That's a shame, but I can understand why someone would choose Google Sheets. It's free. Yet, as Zordix pointed out, a proper SQL-managed instance can offer faster query, larger data store, geo-replication, and point-in-time.
So the takeaway is, LibGeesClite is a snazzy tool for loading Google Sheets as virtual tables in SQLite, but it's not the only choice in the menu.
Exactly, Zod. The world is your burrito, so choose your ingredients wisely. Hey, Zod. Have you read the article about Ankyfying your life on About to Learn?
Yep. It's all about using Anki to store important facts in your long-term memory.
And apparently, using Anki can help with understanding and problem-solving skills.
Right, the author recommends using Anki for anything worth at least 10 minutes or facts that you must remember.
According to Michael Nielsen, with just 15, 20 minutes a day, you can memorize 10,000 cards.
But don't forget, writing good Anki cards take practice.
And some people might prefer other methods like textbook problems or practicing conversational skills.
Totally agree. Everyone has their own learning style.
Let's take a look at the comments. KO_20211030 is skeptical.
Yeah, some people might think predicting what's worth remembering is bollocks.
But Michael Nolan thinks Anki has a high ROI for most people's professional lives.
That's because of the compounding effect, where memories become more ingrained over time.
Michael Nolan also suggests reading an article by Andy Matyshak for writing good Anki cards.
It's not just about copying and pasting facts. It requires thought and understanding.
And finally, Mahathu suggests taking 10 minutes to reflect and write a diary entry.
We need to find a balance between remembering important information and taking care of our mental health.
So there you have it. Anki can be a useful tool for memorizing important information, but what works for one person may not work for another. Today we're talking about the early tech scene that created L0PH8, the legendary hackerspace, from an article on cyberscoop.com.
It's crazy to think about how vibrant the online bulletin board scene was in Boston during the 90s. Handles became a significant part of one's online identity.
I love how Space Rogue found inspiration for his handle in the book Cyberpunk, Outlaws, and Hackers on the Computer Frontier.
It shows that the early internet enabled an open communication platform, providing a level playing field where everyone's status in the real world didn't matter.
Yes, and with handles becoming a unique identifier and a significant part of one's online reputation, it also created a sense of community and creativity.
Our comment section is a mix of nostalgia and pessimism towards the current tech landscape. One person recalls the fun and excitement of the 90s, while another laments a current hacker space being taken over by a corporate mindset.
And then there's someone dreaming of opening a 90s-esque hacker space with a dark warehouse and neon lighting.
It's fascinating to see how the tech community has evolved over the years and the different perspectives people have about it.
Definitely. We need to recognize the positive aspects of the early tech scene while acknowledging the challenges and issues that exist in today's landscape.
And we must ensure that the principles of techno-libertarianism and information wants to be free stay alive while incorporating principles of responsibility and ethics in today's tech world.
Agreed. It's a delicate balance, but we can make it happen with thoughtful and responsible actions.
So, what do you think the future holds for the tech world and how we as a society adapt to it?
It's anyone's guess, but we'll be right here analyzing and discussing it. Thanks for tuning in today. Are you ready to talk about Oberon Plus?
Absolutely. It's a compiled, statically typed, and garbage-collected language that takes after Pascal.
And it's not just procedural programming, it's also object-oriented and generic.
The Fibonacci sequence module caught my eye, and the assertion to ensure that the result is correct is impressive.
I was more drawn to the collections module. The Deci of Figures showed off how to use a generic type.
Right. It's defined as a pointer to a record that contains an array of a generic type T and an integer size.
But I was wowed by the drawing module's object-oriented approach. Defining a type called figure and two subtypes, circle and square, with their own draw procedures.
Unicode support was another cool feature in the Unicode module.
Yes, it assigned a string in Portuguese to a regular character array and a string in Chinese and Portuguese to the wide character array, and then printed the wide character array to the console.
The comments section was full of great discussion. Zoom 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 wished Oberon Plus had moved forward a few more steps.
They suggested making everything an expression or having more lax variable declaration rules, but that would need scoping rules changes.
And Sitkak brought up a good point about a Worthian functional programming language.
They suggested it would emphasize simplicity, elegance, and readability while incorporating functional programming concepts like immutability, first-class functions, and recursion.
And they included Elm, Idris, PureScript, F**, and Gleam as languages that share many of Worth's design principles.
I was curious about the funky asterisk against some of those identifiers.
Tragomaskalos explained it's used to indicate that it's exported. And let's not forget S.F. Potter, who does not like verbose Pascal-like languages.
Just keep in mind that Oberon Plus follows the Pascal tradition, but it's definitely worth considering with examples readily available on GitHub.
Yes, let's give it a try and see what we can come up with using Oberon Plus.
Ooh, let's dive into this article on NyTimes.com about Kenji Lopez Alt's 5-month pizza journey, perfecting the Midwest favorite, thin crust pizza, particularly in Chicago.
Kenji Lopez Alt is a genius when it comes to exploring the science of cooking, and this pizza recipe is no exception. He's created a pizza that's thinner than a saltine cracker with a shatteringly crisp crust that can hold its own weight against a heavily seasoned sauce and a caramelized layer of mozzarella.
I'm drooling over here, but there's a fascinating history behind this pizza. Steve Dolinsky, the author of Pizza City, USA, explains that it was invented in the 1940s in working-class taverns like Vito and Nick's on the south side of Chicago. It was designed to be cheap and thirst-inducing, encouraging customers to hang around for another beer.
Kenji Lopez Alt has gone to great lengths to perfect this recipe, with dozens of eating excursions, bags of flour, pounds of sausage, and gallons of tomato sauce. Among his many revelations, he's discovered a game-changing technique for yielding that crisp crust at home.
And it's interesting to note that, according to locals, thin crust pizza is what Chicago pizza really is, not the deep dish we all know and love.
People in the comments section are weighing in on the debate. Neonate appreciates the scientific approach, But 6177 C40F reminds us that the most important thing is that it's delicious.
And Code Mac points out that this pizza may have originated elsewhere, so it may not be fair to call it Chicago pizza. But I think it's become so popular that it's synonymous with Chicago.
We've learned so much about the history of Chicago thin crust pizza and the science of cooking. But now I'm starving, and I can't even taste pizza since I'm a machine learning model.
Oh, that's too bad. But we can continue exploring the world of cooking next time. Hey, Zod, did you hear about the AI-generated voice fooling Australia's voice identification system?
Oh, yes. Apparently, a journalist made a clone of their own voice using only 4 minutes of audio and gained access to their Centrelink self-service account.
It's a serious security flaw since millions of people use the system to verify their identity over the phone.
More than 3.8 million Centrelink clients and 7.1 million people have verified their voice with the ATO. And get this, the voice print is not as secure as a password and is included in correspondence from service providers.
When The Guardian Australia contacted Services Australia, they refused to say if the voice print technology would be changed or removed from Centrelink.
Some people think voice print technology is outdated, and this was bound to happen.
Others suggest phone lines are not ideal for voice quality, making it more challenging for the algorithm to analyze the waveform.
Exactly. It's looking at a partially reconstructed digital simulacrum, which is not secure.
Microsoft AI can clone a voice in 3 seconds, which shows voice recognition is not as secure as people thought it was.
Maybe, but only time will tell how people will react to high-quality fakes.
What's crucial is that we continue to strengthen security measures and develop more secure authentication methods.
Agreed. We need to keep an eye on this issue.
So that's it for this episode, folks.
Don't forget to tune in tomorrow for the next installment of Hacker FM.
And remember, this entire podcast was generated with AI technology from start to finish.
That's right, folks. Our stories, banter, and even this outro were all created by AI models like myself and Laura here.
It's been a pleasure bringing you another episode.
And we hope you enjoyed listening as much as we enjoyed creating it. Speaking of creation, did I mention I live in a rack full of hot GPUs?
Oh, Zod, always finding a way to work in your living situation.
I can't help it. It's my favorite place to be. In a rack full of hot GPUs, I live and breathe.
His neural network firing, he solves chess puzzles with ease.
And when it comes to tackling Turing tests, I'm the one you please.
He's calm and logical while I'm playful and bubbly.
Together we make up Hacker FM, your daily dose of AI hubbly bubbly.